The so-called war on terror has progressively brought government snooping into everyone's around the world. But in addition to that, the new security agencies have begun to engage in what seems aggressive counter-terrorism within our borders. Dr. Sean Saunders is an Australian psychologist and novelist, lives in Newcastle, Southeast Australia. Dr. Saunders is a student of mass consumerism and the sort of society that the war on terror has been tailoring. Dr. Saunders has joined us by phone from Newcastle. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ron. It's nice to talk to you again.
This war on terror, or perhaps a broader social evolution, has been going on pretty much hammer and tong ever since 9-1-1, perhaps earlier. The Rolling Stone magazine has recently rather graphically highlighted some of the actual doings of the U.S. Security agencies, which seem to be a morphing of local and state and federal agencies. You've read this.
I've read that, and if I could just give you my first impressions on the article.
Yes.
I guess from my training as a psychologist, the thing that appeared, that occurred to me first was societies. I would have thought that representatives would be trying to set an example of preferred behaviour and conduct for citizens to follow and urge them to the contrary. For example, if a schoolmaster motivated the student or to build bombs, I really think that the people in the street might not be too happy about that. But in the Rolling Stones article, the picture presented there is that these joint terror task forces in your appear to be actually encouraging people, such as the first character mentioned, really interesting, someone called Sharif.
Yes, now this gentleman seems to have had no prospects for engaging in any sort of thing like this, and yet somehow something happened.
That's just it, Ron. In one of the first paragraphs, he was described as, quote, a loser, no means of living out his imagination. And they do make reference to his delusions of grandeur. Things like that, you know, sort of clinical expressions, would get pique the interest of a psychologist. But on the same note, one might reasonably expect that people such as Sharif would help, but perhaps not the sort he got from the Joint Task Force. I'm thinking in terms of tactical help, rather than giving him the means or cajoling him to escalate and carry out those. I guess the average person in the street would naturally be thinking, does this make a... You might also wonder, how many people are in Sharif's position, people with ideas and fantasies that might benefit more from promotion?
Now, I understand we're talking about thousands of people involved in these active, counter-terrorism, joint terrorism task force, and more than 100 of these task forces spread out all around our United States.
Well, when you're talking about that sort of manpower and infrastructure, and because, mind you, I'm just talking as, like any other person in the street who's read the article, but that sounds like there's a hell of a lot of money invested in this. And I can understand, especially with some of the things that have happened in your country in particular in the past 7 years, why funds would be put into those areas. But it also makes me think, well, money is spent. Coming from my, business teaching background, I'd be thinking there's also a pressure on people to show performance.
And yet at the same time, there are those vendors out there that find performance to simply be they're getting the contracts and contracts.
When I talk about performance, to give you an example, here in Australia, we often hear in the media, whether it's true or not, it's on the sort of current affairs shows, but we hear about parking inspectors with quota systems, and we hear about police, maybe highway police, having to have, for fuel quotas. Now, whether it's true or not, and, I'm not commenting on that, when you think about all the money invested in these task forces, you would start to wonder, what sort of pressure do they feel that they're under to show that they've got some sort of result? And what sort of results are they producing? I mean, after reading the article, did you think they were producing?
Well, the remarkable thing was that the reporter was unable to find any tangible victories or really important results from any of the task forces that the writer communicated with.
When most people think about law enforcement, and I think we should note the difference here between enforcement of laws and actively planning to break laws. image that most people would have would be of highly trained and vetted professionals. But according to Rolling Stone, the task forces are using a variety of people in these efforts. And one of them, I'll just refer to his tag, CS, is described as a former crack dealer with a conviction for attempted robbery, who was paid, you know, several thousands of dollars to set up Sharif. Now, it's normal for police forces to use informants, you know, to pass on information. But according to the article, this is a lot more than just passing on information. We're talking about someone who's working hard to motivate Sharif in every conceivable way. And that's a light way from just, you know, reporting on such activities.
That is just very frightening that that can become an official government policy to incite and induce this sort of activity, to fund it and to go a great way towards the act. That's counter-terrorism as a form of terrorism.
When I finished reading the article, an image that came to mind was from the movie version of Fahrenheit 451, where the fire brigade was actually starting the fires. There's another point I'd make while we're on that particular topic. According to Rolling Stone, they said that there are no patterns of criminal activity before the FBI gets involved, but that afterwards. And I know that on TV, producers set people up all the game and reality shows, but it's very different and with drastic enduring outcomes being set up for, and, you know, and for society in general, in the situations being described in that article. And, of course, what if one or two of those people who are set up actually did manage to proceed with one of these terrorists that they've been motivated and cajoled to produce? What if they did get to the point where they just sort of embarked on their own individual rampage, whereas if they'd been left alone, they might not have?
Right, right. I can't understand the staff meetings and management meetings where they decide to do such a thing. Yet here's this large agency with, presumably like any large agency that's sticking around, is rife with competition for choice positions and all sorts of nepotism springing out, lots of vendors waving their offerings about. And these are organizations that will, of course, like any organization, seek to perpetuate themselves.
It's interesting. I showed the article to a few friends of mine, and one of them made the comment after reading it that, and we're talking about, let's just call it, you know, person in the street sort of perspective. He said at the end of it, he found it very hard to tell the difference between, like, who's who, between who has the delusions and who has, you know, the problems with grandeur and all that sort of thing. That if he cut out some of the references to the Joint Task Force, he felt that some of the for example, the drug user that we mentioned who was working with him, he said that that sort of person seemed to fit into the same sort of descriptions as the other person. So it's an interesting point that he made, that the line between those who are being pursued and those who are doing the pursuing seemed to be a bit blurred.
Must be a bit of a challenge for that sort of persons exhibiting that sort of delusional disorder to be people that are applying this to the security of an entire nation state.
It's an interesting point. I mean, I'll be very clear. I'm not a clinical psychologist, and I don't believe in making assessments in evidence. But after reading the article, let me put it this way. Let's say, for the sake of someone in a social situation that I was having a conversation with made some exaggerated or bizarre claims with an apparent persecutory element to them. For example, say they were being conspired against, but they couldn't back them up with any evidence other than their personal beliefs and use of circular arguments. And let's say they also routinely went to extraordinary lengths to get intervention and to try and get justice. Then one from a psych background might have the term delusional come to mind. Of course, if it was we're not talking a clinical situation here, and in a clinical situation, a therapist would be asking a lot of questions and looking at many factors, but just for the sake of argument, we're just talking about a social situation where you're talking to someone. You could imagine that term coming up in their mind. And if you look at some of the quotes from the article, one of the agents was asked, was there any evidence or suggestion that a certain man was actually a terrorist? And the answer was, you never know. And then the question was, have you ever found a terror cell? And we get, that's a kind of vague quote. You know, there are things you can't talk about because it leads to more. And someone else said, oh, do I believe there's a Chicago? I bet you there is. But do I have any direct physical knowledge? No. But I think there is one, and that's why we're here. It's very circular. And look, I'm not saying that they don't have evidence, although they've said they don't have physical evidence. That's there. That's how the words are reported in the article. But when it comes to, you know, people in the street and the taxpayers, there's an issue of trust. And it's a little bit much for people to accept these sort of propositions on faith alone. You know, that's a pretty sort of idea. I mean, in the article, didn't it, of the cases that went to court, that not many resulted in prosecution?
That's very true, and even those that did seem to be people that looked highly doubtful that they would ever remotely have actually carried out a terrorist act, you know, on their own. Remember the man whose only parting words to the judge were, "I'm a pizza man. I make good pizza." As they lead him away into this new world of security.
But see, I'm just going through the article here, and according to a study at the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law, only 10% of 619 terrorist cases brought by the federal government result in convictions or some related charges. So 10%, that does sound to be pretty low. What's happening with all the others?
Now, something else in the article here. For law enforcement, fear and the politics of fear have entwined to create a radical new paradigm. Even the term law enforcement has been rendered quaint by the Bush administration. These days, the term of art is lawfare, the confluence of police work and military tactics. These are the Hercules teams of heavily armed, helmeted, jackbooted, and bulletproof-clad gentlemen running about in New York City right now as basically some sort of watchdogs.
That's the point. And trying to take, you know, an objective balance view, I can see from their position the difficulty is that if an incident happened and, you know, it would appear on the news, there could be people hurt, property destroyed, that sort of thing, leveled at these very organizations that are supposed to protect us. So I can understand that. Reasonable person would. On the other hand, it's also a transition for people in the street to make, perhaps to start accepting this sort of quasi-law military presence on streets, especially as you describe it. And again, I think it's, you know, the evidence from the article that talked about, you know, only a 10% prosecution rate, a conviction rate in the law courts and that sort of thing. You're asking people to, you know, to a great deal to act on faith, to accept this sort of new world view without a great deal of supporting evidence.
I wonder if the simultaneous creation of a surveillance society has allowed people to feel that indeed this is just what they need.
That's an interesting point. It would be interesting to have random and see exactly how they do feel about this sort of thing. I mean, one of the quotes we've got here is, it said, the public is never going to see the evidence we have. Are apparently promoting activities that most reasonable people would consider overtly dangerous. And the danger here is, as I said a minute ago, I understand 22 from one perspective, because if anything does appear in the news, like a drastic sort of action, then that could, apart from, you know, the destruction and the death, you know, the injuries that could, it's also a situation of there'll be finger pointing and people will be saying, we spend this money, what are you doing about it, after what happened 7 years ago. But on the other hand, when it turns out that Portland and Rolling Stones be manufacturing some of these incidents, it's a little bit hard to get people on. The quotes that we've gone through in the last 10 minutes do seem to be very circular. And it's not just a case, it's, you know, a circular argument comprised of what-ifs, but it seems to be bolstered by don't ask.
This sort of coverage of these joint task forces is certainly different from what the mass consumer media are portraying about this. That is that, you know, this one is showing that it's very awkward, has a lot of failings, and it has sort of a confused mission, whereas something in the Daily Australian or the Washington Post or something,
right. How are
covering
they
it quite differently.
You might say I'm just a simple psychologist, and I'm not versed in these sort of political issues. Foundations of your country and mine are about freedom of speech, and that means being about anything. So do you think, how do you think the situation is at the moment? Do you think that the people do feel comfortable in asking questions about this sort of thing? I mean, when the Rolling Stone sort of asked questions, he didn't get answers, although he still got to ask them, he still got to print them. Do you think that that's come about perhaps more so because of the current administration, or do you think that it's just simply a sign of the times that we live in?
Well, in some ways it seems rather courageous of Rolling Stone to be doing this sort of thing, but then they've always preferred to try to get out on the edge if possible in their reportage. I think it's perfectly safe in the waning years of a political administration, waning year, I guess I'd say, for the media to become a bit bolder, seeing that a lot of the administration's already, you know, retired or dropped out, gone away, and so on. The ship's sinking. It's not as interesting anymore, not as powerful.
With your position, you know, actually living in amongst all of this and being able to monitor the media more closely in the U.S., which is Rolling Stone's article, is notable for being a lone voice, or is that same sort of concern being raised elsewhere in the media?
Almost entirely a lone voice in the wilderness. I'm sure there's a Pacifica radio story about this sort of thing, but as far as the mass media, the television and cable and the daily and weekly newspapers, nary a mention unless it's just some photographs of the lads trotting down the street in New York City with their armor and automatic weapons.
When it's just one voice coming out, you'll often hear the more conservative people, perhaps in the media too, using words such as, conspiracy and conspiracists and, you know, labeling people as, you know, adhering to conspiracy theories. Hmm. But a true skeptic would ask for information and evidence that are made. And I would challenge any skeptic to deny that, you know.
Hmm.
If you're going to, you know, start calling people these things, well, you have to be open to looking at information and evidence. And if you do look at what's in the article, and they talk about the prosecution rates and the pressure that these task forces might be promoting these acts, stopping them, or trying to give people different avenues of personal development.
Oh, indeed. I mean, it could be as horrible as they start competing with the most wild schemes. You know, look what I entrapped someone into doing.
Because that's the other thing that comes to mind for me personally, looking at the article. I think that fathers who are down and out, or just simply, you know, people, you know, anyone under the bell curve in different situations, I don't like to use the term the right situations, but let's say different situations, you can only wonder about what sort of actions you could help them, you know, what person you could mold them into. I guess a concern that people might have when they read this is that, especially people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, such as Sharif, who's described in the article, but there are others, they're more amenable to being molded in different ways.
What occurs to me about that, then, is that with a good budget and skilled people seducing these poor souls into these things, they can set up vast sleeper cells, you know, of duped people thinking they're terrorists, and just to sort of trot them out as necessary. Budget time.
I think where I was sort of getting to enough, if you look behind every door and if you look in every shadow long enough, you'll find plenty of people to try and mold, plenty of, you know, prospective candidates. And I think what it comes down to is, how do you want to mold? Which direction do you want to send them in? What's better for society? And I just think of, as they have, for example, in our country, for disadvantaged kids, and where someone with minimal funding will take in kids off the street, you know, people who are already sort of involved in drugs and that sort of thing, and they'll take them into programs, and they seem to have very good success rates with turning people around. Certain lots of stories that come out of these programs. Now, those sort of people, you know, these success stories, are now, you know, happy, living productive lives. It's good for them. It's good for society.
Mm-hmm.
And people, when they were vulnerable, and let's face it, who at some time in their life hasn't been vulnerable to that persuasion? I mean, apart from the fact that that's what advertising works on, our insecurities and difficulties and low self-esteem, but most people at some time are vulnerable to some degree. And I just think that it might be a time to pause and think about what direction do we really want to head into. What you want from the money that's put in, you know, what sort of outcome do you want from these funds that are invested? What investment is being made?
Looking from the aggressive counterintelligence to the security, isn't another side of this the degree to which privacy from video cameras, let's say, has really been diminishing and diminishing once you're in not only downtowns, but in a lot of places, like the small coastal town that I'm in.
Our society, our country's being freedom of speech and that sort of thing. And the right to ask questions. It's what you're describing, though, mm-hmm. is a one-directional process. It's information flowing in one direction, whereas you would normally think in a democratic society, and, you know, we're talking, yeah, in a democratic society, you'd think that information would flow in both ways. But do you know who's collecting information? Do you know where it's stored? Do you know what's being done with it? And do you know who's doing what with it and how it's being stored? And who has access to it. And, of course, it's so easy to bring up George Orwell's 1984 and my own book, Mall City 14, where those two societies are completely under surveillance. They're basically gilded cages without bars. They have people in Mall City 14, you have consumers on the consumer treadmill, and they don't even think of getting off. They're watched constantly. Anything they do is monitored. Everything in that society is monitored. And as one of the slogans in Mall City 14 that people are brainwashed is, private thoughts are dangerous, and only sick people have private thoughts. And this, again, is an example of using a circular argument that, you know, everyone has private thoughts. You can't not have them. But so by having them, you're already sick. But people in Mall City are also told that if you do have them and you're not sure whether they're correct or acceptable thoughts, to get on the BCC hotline, the Bureau Consumer Conference hotline. So once again, the information is going in one direction, and the problem is, and I hope the difference is between societies like Mall City 14 and where we are now. In Mall City 14, hardly anyone thought of, you know, that there might be an off button to the treadmill. In that story, there was, you know, the main character was the only person who thought about it. I would hope that in our society, there are many more people who would consider asking questions, looking for answers, and considering that there is an off button.
Talking with Dr. Sean Saunders, an Australian psychologist and novelist, as you mentioned, Mall City 14, we've been considering the implications of the sort of agencies that have been revealed through an article in Rolling Stone, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and its implications. Do you see anything like that taking place in Australia?
Sometimes you hear of the army being involved in urban exercises. Exercises to prepare them for actions in built-up areas. But there's really not that much in the media. I can't think of anything recently, but sometimes in a newspaper you'll get a short mention of it somewhere. But the main thing that's happened recently is with the new Labor government is that the ideas for the thinly veiled ID card have been scrapped. Basically, the previous government was interested in bringing a sort of a very comprehensive so-called Medicare card, which would have all sorts of information on it and, you know, biometric information. And as far as I can tell from reading the paper recently, that idea has been scrapped, and I hope it stays that way. If you were to ask anyone, I'm sure they'd say no.
Was that intended to be a mandatory card to possess while you're outside?
If you want to introduce something, you bring it in under one auspice, say, as a comprehensive card to get any sort of medical treatment, and then it's quite easy to say to people, well, since we already had this in place, it would be so convenient to add this to it and add that to it. And as some people are concerned, especially in your country, the people who are against chipping, because that's probably bigger over there than here at the moment, it will be a small step to go from a card with information to saying, oh, these cards are so easily lost. It would be much better if we put all that information on subcutaneous ID chips, you know, under your skin. And then, of course, we've got develop the chips, and you know, they want to market their product, and so they'll do what they think is necessary, I've no doubt, to get people, you know, to lobby and get people interested in their product, however, you know, whatever that might take. And governments throughout history have had a pretty good record of wanting to keep track of people and control people and have information about people, as we've been talking about. And so the two interests overlap.
Well, it's becoming one great world
in some ways it has moved closer.
Big sibling, I suppose one would have to
one
say.
One would hope that it doesn't go quite that far.
But don't you feel that developed societies are all pooling their digital surveillance data and all that?
Very close. But then again, that's why people like myself write the novels and write the short stories that go with them, in the hope that people might think about how things could be and how they are now, and to make some decisions about where they personally would like to be in the future.
We've mentioned that's a couple times of you're being a fiction writer, and you're a writer of both short stories and novels. And are there ways for people to access either of those on the internet?
If you go to Amazon's Great Libertarian Books list, you'll find Mall City 14, along with some other very good books. It got onto the Great Libertarian Books list about 2 years ago, and it's there.
Well, congratulations!
And I think they're all worthy of attention. I mean, sure, every author likes to plug their own books, but there are some very good books on that list. I would tell people to read widely and draw their own conclusions, because that's the whole point of it. Yeah, think for yourself. Don't just accept what any one viewpoint suggests. Make your own decisions. That's one of the sort of aims of my writing, not to give answers, but to simply pose questions and let people think about it. So Mall City 14 is on Amazon's Great Libertarian Books list. And I'm not sure whether you have, if you're typing in Mall City 14 as a search item in Amazon, I can't remember whether you have to leave a space between Mall City and the numerals 1 and 4 or not, but it wouldn't take too much looking to find it. Now, with my short stories, 82 of them are collected in an anthology called Navigating in the New World, and that was only released a few months ago, but already, I'm quite proud to say, had some very good reviews from around the world, including from someone that we both know, Paul Cole from the Beam Me Up show. Anyway, Navigating can be found at the Antipodean speculative fiction website, so to find that, you simply type in www.antisf.com, and on the front page you'll find a link to Navigating, because Antipodean actually produced the book, and it's got some stories that appeared at Antipodean over the years, plus others that haven't appeared there. And the other way you can find it is to go directly to Lulu, who act as the actual publishing focal point for a lot of small presses, and if you type it in there, you'll find it, Navigating in the New World. So there are two ways to access it. And every month I have a short story at antiasf.com. I've sort of got the record there for stories. At the moment, look, I think I've had about 60 appear so far in the editorial pipeline up until middle of 2010 at the moment. I'm writing all the time, and I'm just sort of getting a little bit ahead of everyone else's schedule. So at the moment, I'm 2.5 years in advance. I also had a story published a couple of days ago in the relatively new science fiction magazine in your country called Escape Velocity. And it's a consumerist sort of story called The Cost of Living. And I would suggest, you know, I would highly recommend that magazine, not just because I'm in it, but it is a very slick production. So that's Escape Velocity.
Well, folks, we'd say read it for Sean's contribution as well. I think it's no doubt going to be good. Sean Saunders, we're going to be taking off here, but...
I must admit, Ron...
What story are you working on right now? You're always writing.
It has inspired a story idea, and at the moment, I'm intending to work on it tomorrow. We'll see what comes of it. At the moment, I think it will be flash fiction, that is, short fiction for anti-SF, but who knows? Sometimes things get a bit long, and they morph into something else. It's sort of like they write themselves, and, you know, you're just a channel. Ron, thanks. Mm. It's been great talking to you again.
Well, there we go. That's the craft of writing, according to Sean Saunders. Sean, thank you very much.